Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Spicer from GameWisdom.com, home to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. We have a great cast for you this week. We're returning to the topic of game preservation. For those of you who've listened to previous podcasts, you know how important of a topic that is for me as someone who likes to study and examine games and game design. For tonight's cast, we have a new guest who actually is the founder and director of the first museum that was made to display publicly preserve video games for the public to enjoy. They are going to be reopening their doors on February 5th, which, if you are listening to this cast right now, should be this very same day. Please welcome the founder and director of the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment, or the MAID, Alex Handy.
Hi, thanks for having me, Josh. Appreciate being here.
Yep, it's great to meet you, Alex. And as I said, even though we are recording this in the past right now, the museum should be officially reopening by the time people are listening to this cast. So to get things rolling, congratulations on the reopening.
Thank you very much. It's a good thing we're recording this ahead of time, because I'm sure the day that we're reopening, I'll be quite busy.
Yes, for sure. Now, I was looking at the information you said regarding the MAID. I know that you guys also had a Kickstarter, actually two Kickstarters, regarding the funding for the MAID. Is that right?
Yeah, we founded, initially got our paperwork approved by the IRS in 2010. And in 2011, the beginning of the year, we did a Kickstarter for $20,000. Mm-hmm. Those funds were used to open our first facility, which was on the second floor of an office building in Oakland. And we have recently moved out because we did another Kickstarter in September. September. That was for $50,000 to move us into a larger facility, which succeeded as well. And we have been working to get the facility up to snuff and putting in walls and hanging stuff and getting everything wired so mm-hmm. that in theory today, the 5th, we will be opening to the public.
Awesome. And again, congratulations on that. And we will definitely be talking about the museum as well as the importance of preserving these games over this cast. Yeah. So to get things started, Alex, since this is your first time on the cast, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and the MAID for people who aren't aware of the museum?
Sure. I've been a journalist for 17-18 years now, and got my start mainly in technology journalism and video games. Mm-hmm. These days I cover software full-time, business software mostly, but in my days as a video game journalist, I came into possession of quite a few interesting relics and items over the years, as you do when you are a journalist. They send you preview copies of games, and, you know, I just also was a collector. So in 2008, at the Laney College Flea Market in Oakland, I found a parcel of 57 hand-labeled EEPROM chips. And these chips were labeled with things like Spy Hunter and Clur and Jigsaw. One of them said CPK Atari. And I looked that up, and there was only, I don't believe there was any Cabbage Patch Kid. No, there was a Cabbage Patch Kids game for the Atari 2600, but it was not this particular game. This game ended up being Cabbage Patch Kids Adventures in the Park for Atari 2600. And it ended up being 12 revisions of the game from start to finish. So it was the very first take on it where you couldn't even scroll screens. And, wow. You know, the fifth take on it has background music added, and you could see each take of the game as it was evolving. It was never actually released. The games industry crashed. It was written across the summer of, I believe, 84, because there's dates on every one of these chips. It was written by a guy named Ed English and another guy named Ed London, I believe, and they never published it. These guys did looping as well. A lot of the code was taken from a game called Looping. Anyway, I published these ROMs on the internet, but there was really no organization that I saw on the West Coast that could take these things and preserve them. You know, Cabbage Patch Kids game is neat, and an unreleased Atari 2600 game is very neat, but it's still sort of an ephemeral thing that needs to be given to like an institution. It's not something that can really be preserved in like, say, the Computer History Museum isn't really equipped to preserve it. It's a very specific thing. So I decided to found the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment, and one of the key, actually two of the key tenets of the museum's founding were, one, we wanted to preserve stuff in an open, publicly accessible fashion, which meant playable exhibits. And two, we wanted to have free programming classes and skills classes for the public, in particular kids, because we're located in Oakland, and Oakland has historically been an area where there have been, a large concentration of poverty in the Bay Area, and, a lesser concentration of the opportunities that we associate with the Silicon Valley. So we've really tried to reach out to local communities, and we have a weekly class for kids to learn how to program, but we also have skills classes for adults. Like, we've taught people how to do Android development and how to do audio development for Pro Tools and PreSonus, how to do things like Unity, C, all sorts of different classes. And our classes will always be free. But the museum itself is basically a playable history of video games, home console and computer games. We try not to do arcade games. There are other organizations that do those, and those take up a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So we're a nonprofit 501c3, and to date we have well over 5,000 video games and well over 100 consoles and computers on hand, and we make nowhere near that many playable, but we have a good portion of things that we know the public wants to see playable, like the original Super Mario Brothers and so forth.
Interesting. The collection of the games that you have, like, are they like games that have been bought, donated, or a mix of the two?
Yeah, to date, the museum, I'd say about 2 years ago, the museum started to allocate about $100 a month towards acquisitions, which is basically money to go to the flea market, to local stores, and to go to libraries have book sales often, where people are donating books to libraries, they don't want them. Well, we go to those book sales and we buy all the strategy guides because we can archive them, and the money goes to libraries. It's like a win-win thing. But that is vastly in the minority. In fact, many months we don't even spend that money. 99.9% of all the equipment we have has been donated for free by the public, because we can give you a charitable tax write-off for the donation. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in terms of, like, do you have, like, modern consoles, or, like, what's, like, sort of, like, the general, like, time frame of the console history that you have at the museum?
Well, we'll take anything that's video game related and console related. Okay. Generally, in the console world, we'll take anything. When it comes to old computers, we've had to start to limit things because we started to get flooded with a certain amount of old computer stuff. But anything games, like, we'll take any kind of games. We do have a sizable collection now of, like, PlayStation 3 games and 360 games. I wouldn't say that that's anywhere near the size of, say, our PlayStation 2 collection. We have well over 1,000 PlayStation 2 games. We'll take what people give us, and people tend to give us what was last generation. So lots of PlayStation 2s came in while PlayStation 3 was out there. I'm anticipating PlayStation 3s and 360s are going to start coming a lot more. The games already have. But it's not like we don't focus on these things. We just, we prefer to focus on the older stuff. You know, we like to tell kids when they come in the door, we don't have Call of Duty. Not because we don't like Call of Duty, but because that's what you want to play. And we don't want you to play what you want to play. We want you to play the original Mario Brothers, maybe Mario 3 and Sonic the Hedgehog. We had a kid come in the other day, and the kid was absolutely obsessed with Sonic. Like, to a very disturbing degree, he was obsessed with Sonic. And I said, have you ever played the original Sonic on the Sega Genesis? And he said, no. I said, get over here. I sat him down in front of it. Within the first 5 minutes, he's going, wow, this is really hard. But 10 minutes in, he caught the flow, and he was on level 3 within a little while. So definitely a less forgiving game, but still a Sonic game. He took to it. That's the goal, is to show the kids. We like to show them where their favorite games came from. If kids say, I want to play Call of Duty, you ask, well, why do you like Call of Duty? What do you like about it? And with adults, they want to play the games they grew up on, right? So it's the same games we want to show the kids.
Yeah. Oh, we definitely need to have an actual conversation about, like, classic video game design at some point. But I'm sure that will take, like, 2-3 hours if we get going on that. Because there's a whole lot there. I love that example about the original Sonic the Hedgehog. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about the Cabbage Patch Kids game for the Atari 2600, I had a flashback to when I had, I think, one of the older Atari consoles. This was when I was, like, 2 or 3 years old. And we had some kind of, like, Strawberry Shortcake game for the Atari.
Mm-hmm.
No idea how to play that game. To this day, I have no idea what that game was about, but I remember playing that. Again, it was, like, 3-4 years old.
Yeah, well, that was about how old those mechanics were at that time, too. Yeah. Most of those games were bumbling in the dark, trying to latch on to some kind of mechanic. They're very much a sort of cookie-cutter. There's maze games like Pac-Man, and there's little racing games with the paddles, or there's, across the street games like Frogger, or really, I think that the greatest game for the Atari 2600 is Combat. I think far and away from a design standpoint, combat is spectacular. I mean, there's like 40 different settings. It's super fun. It's two player. You could ding it for not having a single player mode, but that's like, you know, the two player mode of combat is just the most fun you can have with a console before 1985.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting about having these different time frames for the video game industry. When I speak to a lot of developers, especially a lot of enthusiasts, we talk about how much things have just rapidly evolved over the last 30 years. Again, I get to date myself again, not only playing the Atari, but I remember all the NES games growing up. And, of course, the SNES generation was probably like one of like the best for 2D games, at least around that time.
It was certainly the renaissance period for 2D pixel art. Yeah, everybody who emulates pixel art these days is almost always emulating that. Even if they're trying to go for like a NES feel, they end up creating graphics that could only have been supported on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, and we'll probably talk more about this later on when we're talking about preserving games, but it's kind of interesting to look at classic games today. We've seen a lot of indie developers go for, as you just said, with emulating classic games. We're seeing a lot of them these days reach back in terms of design and that aesthetic. Over like the last year, for instance, there was Odalis of Dark Call, Axiom Verge, and of course Shovel Knight from, I think that was 2014, which I really loved. And again, these were old games that look like they just really just stepped out of a time capsule from 1989.
Yeah, Axiom Verge does a really good job of that. I have to say, I it's not really possible to 100% Axiom Verge, but I came pretty freaking close. Nice. I love that game, and I'm a big fan of the Metroidvania style of play. You know, there's that old emphasis on exploration is really lost on a lot of the modern games. They're all just tunnel shooters. It's I love that somebody has a drawing of like a shooter map.
I was about to bring that
1990
up.
Yes. Shooter map versus like a 2007, and it's a straight line in the shooter map, and then, you know, 96. I mean, think about Daggerfall, right? There's still no game with a single-player mode with a map as large as Daggerfall ever. Mm-hmm. It's like, what, 10 times the size of Skyrim or something like that?
Yeah. And, again, it's amazing to talk about these classic games. It reminds me when I spoke with GOG a few years ago. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked them. I think you'll probably have a similar answer. And that is, why do you think there is such an appreciation for these classic games? Because, I mean, we can talk about, you know, as two older gamers, but why do you think there's so much of an appreciation and love to play these classic games, not just at the Made, but the people who love GOG.com and love these classic revivals?
Well, the same reason that there are art galleries, the same reason that old movies are popular, you know? There's a silent movie theater down in Niles, California, where all of Charlie Chaplin's movies were made, and you can go down there and watch a silent movie. You pay your $5 and go sit and watch a silent movie. That's incredibly anachronistic, right? That's not something you could show on television. Nobody wants to watch a silent movie, but you know, there's a place to go and do that. And there's the, for example, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, or the MoMA in New York, the SF MoMA in San Francisco. You can go to these places and see things that were painted, you know, 80 years ago. Why are people still looking at them? Because they're still relevant today. And then there's the added bonus of video games is, you know, fun is fun. Right. It may be a nebulous concept, just like art is a really difficult to define concept. Fun is kind of a nebulous and difficult to define concept. But you know it when you see it. Right. Like, you know, art when you see it, and you know, fun when you see it or when you put it in your hands and you play with it.
Yeah. And when I saw with GOG, they said a similar thing, especially with the fact that a lot of these games literally don't get made these days. You brought the classic first person shooter example, but we can look at everything from strategy games, city builders. There's still people who love like the original theme park, Populous, etc. And getting these games into the hands of people is just a very effective way to show them just how far we've really come. And in some cases, there are classic games that can still rival modern games. I mean, I know there's still people who every like year or so who will bring out the original XCOM and probably run through a campaign in that.
Absolutely. You know, the original Civilization, you can argue about Civ 5, Civ 4, 3, 2, 1. It's the same game as Civ 1. And not much has changed. You know, maybe there's like partisans now. But a good game design is good game design. You know, there's a reason that Go is still played today. And, you know, chess is beaten. Computers can beat humans. Go is not a solved problem. Computers cannot beat the best Go players in the world. That's because it is an elegant and perfectly designed game. You don't need to change a thing. And, you know, it's been played for thousands and thousands of years. And just like video games, you know, people will play some of the best games. People will play Tetris for the next 1,000 years. Tetris is the go of video games. I mean, mm-hmm. people will be playing that game forever. Solitaire, right? I mean, that's a card game, but you know, the desktop version of that is hugely popular. More person hours have been lost to Solitaire than anything else. Windows Solitaire.
Now, here's a question. One thing that I was just wanting, getting back to the Maid itself. You said earlier in the cast that you started the first Kickstarter for that. Was that in 2011?
Yes.
When was like the actual like museum like open?
September of 2011. And then in November of 2011, we took on the GamePro donation. When GamePro magazine shut down, we went and took everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you had the second Kickstarter when?
In September of 2015.
Okay. And regarding the Kickstarters, they were simply for getting the funding you need to renovate and just essentially build the Maid up?
Yeah, the original $20,000 that we raised for in 2011 was just for rent, internet, and insurance. This $50,000 that we've got, about half of that is for rent, internet, and insurance. The other half is for build-out, and we are currently knee-deep in the build-out.
Cool. Now, one thing that I find interesting is, as you said, the first Kickstarter was in 2011, the second one was 2015. 2011, Kickstarter really wasn't that known to the video game public. A lot of people, including myself, we didn't really hear about it until the big Double Fine Kickstarter, which I think that was 2012, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. When you started the Kickstarter in 2011, I guess, how did you approach building the Kickstarter campaign? Because again, this was long before the likes of myself and who knows how many people have gone to studying crowdfunding and Kickstarter's involvement in the game industry.
Honestly, at the time, I had a friend who knew the CEO of Kickstarter, and we contacted him, and they said, well, you got to do a video. That's the number one thing. And so we did a video, and you know, explained everything else and laid it out, but really, I think it was the video that was the most important thing at the time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, to this day, I think they mandate that you have a video at this point, because at the time, they were like 80% of the ones that have videos get funded, and... You know, it was, yes, it was a new thing, but, you know, it just worked out. It was serendipity, I guess.
Yeah, and the video thing is definitely important. I think it's even more important today due to how much people are now scrutinizing Kickstarters. And that takes me to my next question for you, Alex. When you did the second Kickstarter in 2015, was there any, like, difference in strategy or like a different field?
Oh yeah. Oh my God. We had like a committee doing research and you know, we had a guy who got a Hollywood lighting guy to come down and light the video. It was a major, major, major step up. It was like 10 times the size, much, much, much larger project. And honestly, I got to tell you, I feel like all that work basically gave us the same kind of a result that we had the first time. It's just that the environment that we were fighting into is completely different. People are much more savvy and very scrutinizing of the Kickstarters. I think the thing that really works against us is that we are local. You know, we're essentially a local Kickstarter, right? You know, people who want to come see us have to be within about a 5 to 6 hour drive. So I think that that's what really makes it difficult. And the other end of the Kickstarter thing is if you just show that you've done the work, I think people are willing to believe in you. I mean, there's people out there. I don't know if you saw that one the other day about the obvious, I might not obviously been a joke, but some very, very optimistic child put up a Kickstarter for the Star Wars massively multiplayer game or something, and they wanted to make a Star Wars RPG, and the thing is already, he wanted 200,000, but he got up to 15k. I'm sure he's going to be taken off and he won't get anywhere, but people can be very generous on Kickstarter if they believe in what you're doing. You just have to show them that you're not some knuckleheads. And I have to point out, you know, we closed that Kickstarter in October, and I have the last five packages for the last five packages of stuff to mail out as rewards. Ooh. In my trunk. So everything's already been mailed out. We're opening in February. I mean, we are way ahead of the game on this. I mean, we've got to be in the top 5% of people sending out stuff in Kickstarters, because I personally have funded a lot of Kickstarters, and I've had to wait up to 2.5 years to get my stuff at times.
Ooh.
And others have failed. So we're rocking it. We just sent that stuff out immediately.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you brought that up, Alex. At the time of this, when this podcast goes up, I will already post a podcast I had with a developer friend of mine, Anthony Conta, who I think works at Urban Island Games. They do tabletop games, and we had a whole discussion about the challenges of doing these physical goods and the logistics around it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is like a whole art form in trying to get these goods going, even getting them manufactured and shipped.
Yep. Now, that's why there's a whole industry of people who will come and hound you. If you set up a Kickstarter, you will be hounded by people asking to do your fulfillment. And I got to be honest.
Oh, yes.
You know what? Screw them all. Get your volunteers together. Stuff envelopes and make sure you use the U.S. Post Office. They have these envelopes that they will just give you. Use those things. They're flat rate envelopes. Mm-hmm. That is the best advice I can give to any single person in the entire world who ever wants to do a Kickstarter. Get the flat rate envelopes from the post office and just do that. Because anything else is going to be awful. But we literally, like, we had 400 donors. We just stuffed envelopes. You know, spend a Saturday, you get some pizza, you stuff envelopes.
Yeah. Now, with the Made itself, I was looking at the email you sent. The new location, it's going to be 4,400 square feet?
Yes.
And how big was the original form of the Made?
Well, the original space was 2,100 square feet, and then we opened 900 square feet across the hall. The ceiling collapsed in there one night. Nobody was hurt, but we had to... Mm-hmm. That was fun dealing with the landlord. And we opened up another facility down the hall that was replacement for that, but it was never made ready for us, and we were unable to use it. Mm-hmm. Then we added another 300 square feet. So at the end of the day, we were about 2,500, 2,700 square feet of usable space, when in fact we should have been 3,500, but we were in negotiations with a rather unfriendly landlord at the time, but he's gone. So we're in the new building with some very friendly people, and we basically doubled our space.
Great. Now, with, like, I know obviously since we are talking 2 weeks before the museum's going to be reopened, but thinking about the future, do you guys have plans to, like, expand, or is this, like, enough space or more than enough space for you at the moment?
Right now, it feels like it's enough space. I'm sure that we will need to expand, and the plan has always been to expand, you know, when we can. In the last building, you know, we sort of oozed across the hall into the rooms across the hall that were open. The last 350 square feet that we added was for the Danny Buntonberry Memorial Retro Computing Lab, which in the new space is around 1,000 square feet. So that's a bit of an upgrade, right? That's going to make things much better.
Interesting. Now, one question, I think you may have answered this earlier, but I just want to clarify. For people wanting to visit the Made, is there a cost of entry, or is it completely free to the public?
No, it's a $5 admission fee. Okay. Our classes are completely free, and there are meetups and tournaments that are free. Our Smash Brothers tournaments are just massive. Mm-hmm. It's like I think it's a $2 venue fee if you want to come watch. But our Smash tournaments are probably the best Smash destination in NorCal. We frequently get ranked players in NorCal. But we're also adding, like, we're going to have Street Fighter V is coming up, so we're going to add that. And those, you know, those are like a $1 or $2 venue fee. But if you want to actually come into the museum, it's $5 a head. And, I think that's a fairly cheap price for what we're offering.
Yeah. And since you have all these classic games, you got to eventually have some kind of, like, tournament like the movie The Wizard. I mean, it just screams for it with all the classic games.
I would absolutely love to have classic games tournaments. I just don't have the weight of people demanding it, and I don't have somebody to run it, honestly. I'd love to do that, though. We're up for anything. If somebody wants to come in and help us out, we're all volunteer run. Nobody gets paid, so it's all a labor of love. And the folks that I have now love Street Fighter V and Smash Brothers, so that's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, what better games for fighting tournaments right now? The competitive game scene has always been steadily growing. I mean, we talk about classic games. I still remember the old days of Street Fighter 2 of the arcade. I know you said that arcade machines don't really fit with the Made, again, due to their size. But it's kind of interesting to see how much the competitive aspect has really grown over, like, the last 5-10 years.
Yeah, and I'm not saying we don't have arcade games. We have a Neo Geo system, you know, with all the fighting games on it, which is very popular. It's literally just a size and need thing. There are many organizations that are dedicated to arcade preservation. There's not as many as we need, but there are a few. And, you know, the Made is no longer the only video game museum in the world or in the United States. There's a Strong Museum of Play, which actually predates us, was a part of the Strong Museum of Play. Just categorizes everything from board games to dolls to toys. But they have an excellent Center for the Electronic Game. That is a terrific, terrific facility. There is also the SIM, the Seattle Interactive Museum of Multimedia, which I don't know if they have a home right now, but they were in Seattle. And then there's the Video Game History Museum down in Texas. They just opened up a few weeks ago. So, you know, there's a few organizations out there, but there's, you know, we always need more, right? Like, think about how many organizations out there are dedicated to art preservation. There's thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's maybe in the whole world, maybe 10 organizations and governmental arms that are dedicated to game preservation.
Yeah, and that is definitely one of the issues we talked about on the last cast. And I think this will be a good way to start to lead into talking about the importance of game preservation, which leads me to a question I've been really curious about for the museum, Alex, and that is keeping these systems and keeping this hardware maintained and supported. One of the challenges for anyone, for our younger audience listening, one of the challenges with a lot of classic systems and hardware is that it can be very hard to keep them maintained. A lot of these systems weren't meant to last 20-plus years. I mean, I remember growing up and having to blow into the NES cartridges, and that was during its heyday.
Well, you still have to today.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, preservation is a big job. As an all-volunteer organization, it's really hard to find people with the skills to keep this stuff preserved. However, we did recently find a guy named Zach who is like Mr. Sega. He can fix anything Sega. Nice. And he repaired some Sega CDs for us and some other stuff. You know, we have to actually like pay him for his work because he is a very skilled person. And I wish we could pay him more than we already do and, you know, use him more often. But generally, you know, it's no matter what you know about, no matter how much you know about these systems, it always just comes down to like you got to crack them open, you got to clean the contact points, you got to use the duster, and if stuff's blown, you got to desolder it off of one and solder it onto another. It's a lot of work. It's a very technical work, and generally the way that we deal with it now is we just have multiple redundant systems, right? Like I have a stack of NESs, and I also I have the capacity at the museum of being the NES whisperer. So 9 times out of 10, I hear NES isn't working, and I just have to come over and sort of blow into it and wiggle it a little, and all got working.
Another thing I'm curious about with the MAID, besides having like all the consoles and older computers set up for people to play, you mentioned earlier that you also collect and archive strategy guides. Do you do like any other like written information, like any kind of like historical stuff for people who are interested in the history of these games as well?
Yeah, we don't do enough active like things like you're doing here with podcasting and generating original content. What we do is we publish old content that hasn't been out there. So one of the things we did was GamePro. When we took the GamePro magazine assets, that was over 3,000 games and a lot of ephemeral items, including a box of videotapes. And there's a lot of audio tapes and videotapes in there that we still need to go through. You know, they're things like audio tapes of focus groups, right? Those are of, I don't know really how, I'm not really confident that that's an important thing for us to preserve in a public fashion. Maybe in 10 to 20 years, it'd be more important to do that. But what we did find were the original reels of the GamePro TV show from 1995, 1996. Ooh. Now, that's not the original show that you may remember, which was really sort of a 1992 extreme kids, you know, neon color. That's a different show. This is there were four or five episodes. Well, we put them all on YouTube. We captured them all, put them on YouTube. They're brilliant. They're absolutely wonderful. If you want to like see some of the first shots of Tomb Raider and them discussing things like Pokemon coming out in Japan, it's really, really, really good stuff.
Oh my goodness.
We also published something called The Making of Radical Rex, which was an hour and a half long video about an Australian developer making a Super Nintendo game called Radical Rex. And it's basically like shows you all the tools, all the computer stuff that they did. And it's that's the kind of stuff we're really into preserving, these things that are around the games, you know?
Yeah.
We're working to release the source code for Habitat very soon too.
Interesting. And my mind just like went back when you said time before Pokemon. It seems like such a strange concept these days, but again, I get to feel old. I remember that time where like, this Pokemon thing's coming to the United States? What the hell is this thing? It's not going to last. It won't be that popular, right?
I remember very vividly buying my copy of Pokemon Red as an 18-year-old man in Toys R Us, and everybody's looking at me like I'm freaking crazy, and I felt like a maniac walking around with my Game Boy and going to Kentucky Fried Chicken and buying all the plushy dolls, and they had little Beanie Babies for Vulpix. What did they have? They had Vulpix. They had Eevee. No, I don't think they had Eevee. Zubat, of course. Zubat everywhere. the early days of Pokemon when there were only, what, 150?
Yeah. What are they up to now? It's like over 700, I think.
Only 150 for me.
Oh, speaking about promotion material, I think I still have, like, I remember, like, Nintendo used to sound like these, like, VHS cassettes or tapes.
Yeah,
of,
like, yeah. Now, that's the kind of stuff that we like to preserve, too. Now, we haven't, like, put any of that stuff online, but we have boxes of that stuff. One of the things that I actually did, I just did this a couple of days ago when we were setting up the museum, is I put all of our magazines on a shelf. That's fun. Reading through the old game magazines.
Oh, yeah. I still have all my old magazines.
And there's a lot of stuff in there that shows games that were never published. There's lots of interesting stuff out in that. Those are a wealth of information.
Oh, yeah.
And sadly, few of them are scanned, but a lot of this stuff is on archive.org. If you're a fan of any of these things, you need to go and spend a lot of time at archive.org. That is the greatest institution for preservation of digital documents on the face of the planet. It is a travesty, a crime against humanity that there is only one archive.org in the world.
Yeah, definitely it's a shame about that. This has been a really amazing cast so far, Alex, and I feel that if you didn't have to go in a few minutes, I think this would easily be like easily an hour and a half, 2 hour cast of us just talking and reminiscing about video games.
Well, it's a very big topic, and it's really just, it's not addressed in the modern world as well as it should be. There's basically one person in the Japanese government tasked with cataloging all of Japan's cultural video game assets, and there's one person in the Australian government doing the same thing. The United States lags woefully behind. They basically picked the youngest guy in the office at the Library of Congress to be in charge and put all the stuff on a shelf. I've seen pictures of the shelf. I don't think they have any organization. I don't know how they're organizing it. They got PC games next to PlayStation games. I don't think they have any of the systems to play this stuff. I mean, it's a mess, but there's no standards. There was a guy named Andrew Pertree up in Seattle, the Sim guy, and he was working on standards. I believe they're done, but there's some very, very, very in-depth standards on preservation, and I've always said that we were going to use his standards, but you know, that's a lot of work to do that kind of archival preservation.
Yeah, I would love to do stuff like that, especially examining and, you know, talking more about classic game design. One of the things I love doing here on Game Wisdom, I mean, for anyone who's listened to previous casts, you know that we can get into very lengthy discussions about game design, and especially comparing how things have evolved and changed. It's definitely one of my favorite subjects. But as you're saying, Alex, it definitely, especially preserving and understanding classic games, it really is something that is not given, like, as much credit and importance as it should be, especially in regards to the industry as a whole.
Yeah, the tragedy of this industry is that game developers are basically ephemeral. Game development houses, companies that are actually making these games, basically the day they're founded, they have a timer over their head, and they're going to die eventually. And it's horrible, it's a tragedy, but what ends up happening is they either get acquired or they just vanish, and all of the stuff around them making whatever games they were, no matter how amazing these games were, that stuff either goes to the garages of the guys who founded the company, or it goes to the landfill.
Yes.
I personally have had people go, when they were working at Electronic Arts, dig out of the dumpster folders and three-ring binders of assets and information that we now have in the museum, which, I don't know if we should have them or not, but I'll tell you what, there's some very important documentation in there from Origin, one of the companies. They're the guys who did all the Ultima games.
Yeah.
There's like some original descriptions of the games, the original game description, original plot summaries, all this stuff that basically you would call EA on an 800 number, and then they would have like a support line. You could ask them questions. These are the binders that those people were reading from.
Yeah.
And all that stuff was thrown in a dumpster. That's just awful.
Yeah.
You know, we have like two binders.
And that takes me to a really important statement that I want to say, but there's one question that I want to ask you about, Alex, before I get to that. Going back to the Maid for a second, I'm just curious, do you guys do anything with, like, import titles? Like, do you have any, like, Japanese systems?
Yeah.
Stuff like that?
That stuff tends to be, there's specific systems that were popular. For example, we have a litany of Sega Saturn Japanese games. In particular, Sega Saturn, like, dating sims. There was a guy who donated to us all of his extras, because what he would do is he'd go on eBay and he'd buy all the lots, the groups, you know, a whole lot of Japanese Saturn games, and just to get one game in that group, and then he'd have like eight copies of Sakura Chronicles 2 or something like that, you know. So he sent us all those. So for example, we have a lot of that. We also have a lot of Famicom games, or, you know, there's a lot of internationally bootlegged Famicom games that people have donated to us, you know, the games they had when they were growing up in China, stuff like that. But when it comes to like PlayStation 2 games, not necessarily. Super Nintendo, not so much. We have some, you know, we have some imported games. Don't get me wrong, but the Sega Saturn and the Famicom are the systems for which we have the most imported games, I would say.
All right. And one other question I just thought about: besides having these classic games and the classic systems, do you use like ROM emulation at all for certain titles?
We do when the system itself is a real difficult thing to show. So, for example, if we were going to show something in the Atari 800 computer, generally we can show that on physical hardware, but it's not the most reliable, and it can be tough to get that to keep that up and running. So, if we can emulate that and use the original joystick, that's definitely a better choice for us. We prefer to emulate only when the hardware we have is flaky or in danger of being destroyed by being publicly displayed. You know, that being said, when it comes to old PC stuff, everything has to be emulated out of DOS. You know what I mean? DOS box. Like when we showed TIE Fighter, we had to run that in DOS box.
And getting back to what I wanted to say a few seconds ago, you made a really good point about how the industry really does not do a good job in preserving and really being as transparent as it should be. One of the things that I really want to strive for with Game Wisdom is to talk more about the design and the workings of game development, because it is a topic that most game developers or publishers don't really talk about, and one thing that a lot of consumers really don't understand. And I think that has also led to some issues with game evaluation and just trying to understand what it means to make a video game.
Yeah, I'm not really certain how relevant it is to the everyday consumer, but certainly relevant to the people out there who are like kids that want to become game developers and they're growing up, right? It's if you go to film school, you're going to want to read books about like how Stanley Kubrick made games. If you're going to go to the software development school to become a game programmer, you want to read John Carmack's .plan file. And, you know, all Carmack has like generated a wealth of information about how he developed software. That's what you're going to read. Now, can you go out and read something similar from Shigeru Miyamoto? No. You know, Nintendo keeps him locked away in a room and he doesn't really get to talk, right? You know, from a Nintendo perspective, I guess that's the right thing to do. From a humanity perspective, that is not the right thing to do. You know, it's like Rembrandt had a school, right? Rembrandt had a school. You go learn from Rembrandt, and there's a whole bunch of paintings out there attributed to the school of Rembrandt. Our Rembrandt is Shigeru Miyamoto, and he does not have a school. He has a team, and if you know, it's a small team inside of Nintendo, and he is like, he's basically like their asset. He belongs to them. He is Nintendo. It's kind of an injustice to the man. It's a great injustice that I think is done to the man. Nothing, you know, nothing against Nintendo, but like it's like Hayao Miyazaki. You know, his films, it's his studio, right? Like he runs the whole thing, and but he is still considered the treasure of Japan, right? And Shigeru Miyamoto is a national treasure of Japan, but yes, the average person on the street, who's Shigeru Miyamoto, and they're not going to know. It's very shame. It's a great shame.
And that really extends to a lot of areas of game development and the industry as well, especially when you look at the difference between AAA and indie studios. I know we're getting off topic, but just to quickly get this point out, when you look at most AAA studios, it's pretty much just like an amorphous entity. You don't know who's making this game. Most of the time, the publishers, you know, hide that fact or put way back in the credits. I think one of the nice things, at least about indie developers these days, is just how transparent it is, especially when doing stuff for Game Wisdom. I mean, I can send an email and talk to the actual guy, and that wouldn't be possible anywhere else. I mean, hell, if I tried to do that at Nintendo, they would probably, you know, tackle me at the front door and try to get in to see Shigeru Miyamoto.
Yeah, no, I feel that, in general, the best video games are generally the result of a single vision. Now, in the indie scene, that tends to mean one person, right? Now, that that doesn't have to. It could mean the vision of a team. But when that vision is carried through from beginning to end, you get a good game. Half-Life, for example, right? Like, that game went through hell. I don't know if you know this, but the development process for Half-Life was ridiculous. They went through a complete engine shift halfway through the development and, you know, added another 2 years to the game. You think that the development of Half-Life 3 is a long time back in the day. This was a really long time to wait for a game. But it was amazing, and it was amazing because it was not besmirched along the way. It was like, well, this is the way we have to go. And I think Kojima just went through this with Konami, right? Like, he damn near bankrupted them making that game. Damn near bankrupted. I mean, basically did bankrupt Konami making that game. But it's a great game, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a terrific game. Possibly the best Metal Gear Solid ever made. Maybe? Do you think? I don't know. I mean, 3, everybody loves 3, but I never played 3, so I can't judge it on. certainly better than 2.
That we can agree on that.
We can agree on that. So it's an amazing game. And why is it an amazing game? Because it's Kojima. And it's like his vision and his stamp is on that game, man. You know when you're playing a Kojima game because nobody shuts up and there's people doing really weird stuff and acting incredibly serious about it, right? Like, that's his stamp. You know when you're playing a Shigeru Miyamoto game because it's really bouncy and fun and inviting and colorful and happy and joyful and there's lots of jumping around and bouncing and things are going. It's these stamps come through. The personalities of the developers that make these games come through. Like, you can tell when you're playing a John Carmack game because it goes really, really fast and you're shooting a lot of stuff. It's really bloody, right? Like, it's the same thing with Rockstar. Like, there's that special Rockstar stamp on Grand Theft Auto games. And maybe that stamp is like juvenile humor, but it's still, it's got this little stamp on it. And Blizzard is another perfect example.
Oh, yes.
Take a look at Hearthstone. If you look at Hearthstone, anybody who looks at Hearthstone and thinks, oh, that's simple, has no idea what they're talking about, has never, like, doesn't know anything about
video games.
That game has so many beautiful little touches and attentions to detail. Mm-hmm. Every card has its own sound effect and its own little animation. My God, can you imagine the asset generation pipeline for that?
Oh,
it's ridiculous.
God,
Like, that is a vision that is carried through. I don't know what they do at Blizzard, but they have an amazing quality of vision and they always carry through. I'm pretty sure that vision is pretty much centered completely around game balance. Like, perfect game balance. Like, this game's done. Great. Spent two years balancing it, right? Whatever that vision is, that carries through, and that makes them good games.
Yeah, and time after time on this cast, I hear just the same thing from a lot of the developers I've spoken to. It's about that vision. It's about making your game. When I spoke with Ernest Adams, we basically coined harmonizing. All the elements of the game just work together.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like nothing was just, you know, stitched together. Nothing was added on just for the sake of it. It feels like a complete perfect vision.
Absolutely. Dark Souls does this too.
Yes.
It's a game where you can't see the joins. You know, like, you can tell good carpentry because you look at the corner of it and you can't see the join. They're just these two pieces of wood basically are blended together like they're one. In a good game, the sound effects, the art, the plot, the gameplay all blends together so that you can't tell which of them is the great thing. They're all just making this great thing. Like, Half-Life is a perfect example. Half-Life 2 is a perfect example of this because you think about Half-Life 2, do you think about audio, like sound? No, you don't think about music. It's not a musical game. But when you're playing that game and you come around that corner and that, like, that one song comes up, you know, like, there's the great tunes in that game. Mm-hmm. It only plays for like a minute, but man, that minute you're like, you're popping off and shooting guys and dodging, and it's just the perfect, everything comes together, right?
Yeah.
It's not mayonnaise all over everything. It's just the right amount of mayonnaise.
Yeah. And bringing this back to these classic games, we see this with a lot of these very challenging, very complicated games. Again, going back to the original XCOM, that's a great example of a game where they somehow managed to take these three completely different game mechanics and systems, and it all fits together into one thing. So you're not just playing, or I'm sorry, you don't see XCOM as just a strategy game or just a tactical game. You see it as an XCOM game.
Mm.
The same thing goes for Dark Souls and all the examples you just mentioned. You can't really pick one element that stands above the rest. Everything just combines into this amazing experience.
No, certainly. And yet, at the same time, all these games very staunchly stand in specific genres.
Yeah.
Maybe they straddle a couple of genres, but they still exist in genres, which is a very interesting thing about video games. You know, mechanics really sort of tie things into genres in a way that you don't get in movies. Yes, there are genre movies, but every genre movie can be different. Barbarella, very different movie from Star Wars, but they're both science fiction movies, right? But, you know, at the same time, Dark Souls is a very different game than, say, Zelda. But at their core, they're kind of very much about the same thing, like hack and slash and exploration.
Yeah. And one of the things that we're seeing a lot these days is developers starting to combine or subtly add other genres or other mechanics into their games.
It's been going on for years.
Yeah, Call of Duty with like RPG mechanics.
That's the one that really started creeping into everything.
Yeah.
Everything had RPG mechanics after you. Everybody's got levels and experience points.
Yeah. And I guess here's a general question. I know we're probably going to run a little bit later, but one thing I just really want to ask you, Alex, again, keeping with the theme of The Maid and preserving these classic games, do you find yourself, like, as a director and founder of The Maid, do you find yourself going back to playing these classic games as opposed to playing more games, or you find yourself sort of maybe balancing between the two?
Oh, I definitely strike a balance between the two. You know, we have one of the great things about having so many great volunteers at the museum is that I have a totally different perspective on the history of games because, you know, they each grew up with a different system, right? Some of them grew up on the N64, some of them grew up on the Saturn, some of them grew up on the PlayStation 2. So I get to hear about the games they grew up on. And that's really, you get to the people that have this weird sort of love for a, I hesitate to call any game bad because, frankly, making a game is an incredibly difficult endeavor. And if you can make a game, you, sir, madam, are a quality and class individual who has an amazing amount of discipline. But I find that people who come into the museum, a lot of people who grew up on games have that one game that nobody ever played, nobody ever knew, and they, you know, their aunt got it for them, and everybody who ever played it thought it was terrible. But God, I just love this game, and I just want to play this game again. It's really interesting to see what that game is for, say, every volunteer or every person that comes in the door, because it really broadens your perspective. There is some really interesting and weird stuff out there that you and I have never heard of. You know, nobody's heard of except for, you know, a handful of people. And when they walk through the door and tell you about it, it's really interesting to say, you know, hey, have you ever played this NES game? And you've never heard of it. Here I am 30 years on, and there's a new NES game I get to play. Well, that's great.
Yeah. This has been an amazing cast so far, Alex. And as I said earlier, I feel like if you didn't have to go, we would sit here for the next 2-3 hours.
But probably could.
I know that, again, we're recording this about 2 weeks before the museum reopens. I have to get up early in the morning, so I know we both have daily life pushing in on us. So I hate to say it, but I think we better start to wrap things up. So I guess some general wrap-up questions then for you, Alex.
Sure.
As we said, the museum's going to be officially open on February 5th. Are you doing any, like, special, like, day, like a big, like, party or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. On the 5th, we open it from 6 to 9 for a big old party, along with the Oakland First Friday, which is a big art movement in Oakland. But we'll be open on that's on the 5th, and on the 6th and 7th we'll also be open. The Super Bowl is in the Bay Area, so if anybody's coming in for the Super Bowl, you're more than welcome to come over to the Video Game Museum. And our classes will be beginning on the 6th and 7th as well, and Interactive Fiction Club meets on the 1 p.m. on the 6th.
Awesome. The museum sounds amazing. I would love to get out there at some point. I think we're like on complete opposite coast. I'm right in New Jersey, so that's East Coast here.
Go to Rochester, see the Strong Museum of Play.
Cool. Yeah, but maybe one day we'll have to hang out at some point because it sounds amazing and it sounds something like right up my alley. Again, with Game Wisdom, I love talking about these games and trying to bring these topics into the public eye more because, again, as we've sort of hinted at over the cast, these kinds of conversations don't happen all that often in the public space.
Yeah, it's not a hot topic.
Yeah. All right. So, as I said, you have to get going, and I wish we could talk more, but we definitely need to schedule another cast at some point. Obviously, not within the next 2 weeks. I'm sure you're going to be very busy, and I'm sure come February 5th, you're going after the whole day's over. I bet you're going to be sleeping for the next day or so.
Yeah, I'll be very tired, as will all of my volunteers who really do the lion's share of the work. We'll have to talk after we open up, so maybe sometime in March.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, we're going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Again, Alex, it was a pleasure meeting you tonight. And as I said, even though we are recording this 2 weeks early, definitely congratulations on the reopening of the May, and I hope that everyone enjoys it as much as you and the rest of your volunteers.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you, Josh.
Awesome. So for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for this episode. If you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we still have our options currently available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. I am looking for pretty much anyone right now. If you're a student, enthusiast, developer, as long as you're interested in talking about games and game design, definitely shoot me a message. If you'd like to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the little Patreon banner on the front page, and any donations will be greatly appreciated. And as always, if you'd like to catch the various videos I've been publishing on YouTube and Twitch, you can catch them on the YouTube channel, which there is a link on the front page, as well as watch my Twitch stream most nights at 10 Eastern under GW Bicer. So unfortunately, we didn't get too far in our topic on game preservation, but there's always a part two, maybe even a part three. So be sure to stay tuned for that. Hopefully, well, I guess at this point, sometime in March, because I know, Alex, you're going to be very busy for the next few weeks.
Yep, we sure will be.
Great. All right, with that said, we're going to end things here. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you all next time. Take care.